Say, kids, what time is it?
It's time for the Rich Outcast again. Again? Does anybody actually say again? I don't think so.
I dream of little monsters crawling up my leg. I fear they'll come again if I go to bed.
This is Rish, and I am driving, and this is the second episode wherein I talk about Into the Furnace. And you know what that means? That means that the audiobook version is out there, and you can buy it. That's exciting. Now, this episode is going to be a little bit more about the book, but I'm going to try and remain spoiler-free, and you are free to listen to this episode before you buy the book, or, you know, not buy the book after you listen to this episode. But I am going to do a third Into the Furnace episode eventually, and it'll be the spoiler version, the spoiler cast, where I just kind of talk about that aspect of the book, you know, the other stuff. I'll probably use the F word in that one. But in this one, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the audiobook, and I'm going to talk about art. And hopefully, it'll sell a copy or two. I mean, I'd like to sell a lot of copies, but I don't think it likely, and I'm not somebody who can easily hide. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. Into the Furnace is my novel, and it's for you. Sorry, I don't know where that came from. I was at work last night, and I did some kind of silly little voice, like I always do. And this girl, Kelly, that I work with, this woman, Kelly, said, "Were you in drama in high school?" And instantly, I sort of went red, and I felt embarrassed. Because, yeah, that was something that you would be persecuted for in high school. I mean, actually, the bullies would just seek out the weak. So if you liked comic books, or you liked playing with yourself, or you liked drama, or you played a musical instrument, or you wore glasses, or you were fat, or you were skinny, or you were short, or you were tall, the bullies would try to exploit that. And, yeah, I was embarrassed sometimes about being in drama. And all that came back last night. And I said, yeah, I didn't play sports. I didn't have a date to the prom. And she was like, no, I thought it was fun. It was cool that you did that little voice. I wasn't criticizing you. And I said, oh, okay, that's cool. Well, that just stuff never changes. High school never ends, as you well know. So, yeah, I just did that little Elton John thing. And I ought to cut it out. That would be great. But that's sort of what you're here to listen to. Do you know what I mean? If you listen to the show, you listen for that kind of weirdness. Because that's me. I don't imagine you're on here for the stories. Not like the Dune Steve, or you're here for Big Anklevich. You're here for my weirdness. And Into the Furnace is out there. And you can buy it. And Abby Hilton wants me to get this out of the way as soon as I can. Into the Furnace is a weird Western. And, yeah, you know, I thought about it before she ever said weird Western to me. I thought, okay, you know, I'll have to market it as a Western mystery or mystery set in the Old West. Or maybe there's a horror aspect. Maybe there's a fantasy aspect. A Western fantasy, a fantasy Western, a horror Western. I don't know. You know, somebody wanted to say that it was Jaws set in the Old West. I guess that's okay. You know, that sort of thing. Anyway, weird Western. But the story is out there. I worked really hard on the audiobook. I mean, I worked really hard on the text as well. But the audiobook is where it's at, guys. Because that's my bread and butter, man. That's where I shine, is in the narration, in doing the voices, in the dramatic aspects of the book. A good narrator can elevate the material. I don't think a good narrator can make a bad book good, but I certainly hope that my narration has made a couple of mediocre books and short stories out there, tolerable, if not good. I've got this guy at work who I've sort of become friends with. He's my boss. He's the second in command of the whole, you know, place. And he seemed really, really friendly toward me. Now, I'm granted, he's probably friendly toward everybody. He's a people person. A very nice guy, handsome guy, smooth guy, young guy, with it guy. He's the kind of guy you want to please. The kind of guy that you like immediately. Which is kind of leadership material, you know what I mean? I can see somebody saying, "Ooh, I like that guy. I'm going to work twice as hard because he's my boss." He really, really likes reading. He likes books. He likes Stephen King. He likes fantasy. He really likes Harry Potter. And I found out recently that he's an artist. I went to a comic convention. I was talking about these guys in Artist Alley. And Artist Alley is something that they've had forever, where artists just have a little booth, and they will sign books, and they will do sketches, and they're trying to sell things, you know, their art, posters, and that sort of thing. And from the very first convention I went to, this has existed. And I told him about the most recent one I went to, and that some of these artists are not very talented. But the fans of popular culture properties can be so voracious or so rabid that even if you're not a really great artist, they might buy something that has their favorite character on it or they have an emotional investment in. And so I was telling him about this guy who worked at the same company before Austin was hired, before the guy, oh, I just said his name, so there's that. And that he has this really cartoony style, and it's not great, but even he makes money on it, and he's gone to a couple of conventions, not just locally, and sold his stuff. And so I said, well, Austin had said that he was an artist, and I said, have you ever considered doing something like that, selling your stuff? And he says, well, I'm not really a comic booky kind of guy or a cartoony kind of guy. What I do is ultra realistic stuff. And when he said that, I thought, oh, okay, I guess, I mean, if I were this handsome and successful and liked, I'd probably have a pretty big head myself. But later, after we'd known each other a little longer, he showed me some of his work. And I understood what he meant by ultra realistic. His style is, it's like Drew Struzan's style or Jason Palmer's style. You know, you can tell who it's supposed to be. And if you squint, it's a photograph. He had decided he was going to do this art for Harry Potter. And he showed it to me. And he had used photographs as reference. And if you looked closely, you could tell the difference between the photographs and the art. But you had to look. So it was that realistic. And, oh gosh, I digress, guys. Before he showed me this art, when he was telling me that he was an artist, I said, well, you know, if I had a little bit more confidence, I'd probably ask you to do a cover for one of my books. And he said, oh, I'd love to do that. And I, you know, that was nice. But I didn't think he would. And a couple days later, he says, so have you thought about that? I said, thought about what? About me doing a cover for one of your books. And I said, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I'll probably never have you do it, but I think it's cool that you would be willing. And he's like, oh, well, why would you never have me do it? And it was weird. I almost got the impression he had his feelings hurt by that. And sure enough, like the next week, he said, hey, I'm going on vacation next week because I got too much sick time. I have to take it or I lose it. I wouldn't mind working on one of your covers for this time. I said, well, I could probably give you something, but I don't know what it would be. And it occurred to me either that day or at the end of that day that he really wanted to do this. Like, it sounded fun to him. He's not just doing me a favor. He's like, no, I wanted to collaborate, or this is a challenge. I want to do this. And so I did a sketch for what I figured would be the cover of Into the Furnace. And I said, you know, you can do this if you want. And then it was after that that I saw how good this guy's art really is. And that got me excited. Because this guy is really talented. He could do this for a living. He could go to those conventions and sell lithos of the art that he's done, you know, of his Harry Potter stuff. He could just do Harry Potter and make money on it. But it made me excited that this guy's doing the cover for my book. And the sad thing is, I don't have a very dynamic cover in mind. Basically just three buttes and then some skulls, because I don't really want to give away all that the book is about. And I'll talk about that in the spoiler episode. Right now, it's weird, because it's naive as F to say this, but I wanted the book to sell on its own merits. But, well. We'll talk about that again. I didn't want to give everything away. It's like in the 80s, there would be these monster movies or slasher films, and the movies would come out in the theaters, and a movie like Gremlins, and the whole idea was go to see the movie so you can see what the gremlins look like. Or E.T., the extraterrestrial. Go see the movie so you can find out what E.T. is, who E.T. is. What does he look like? But then when those movies came out on video, they just used the gremlin on the cover. They showed Stripe on the cover and Gizmo. They showed E.T. on the cover, even though they sort of meet out this revelation throughout the film. And in these horror movies or these slasher movies, you might not see the killer until the end. You know, you don't see Jason Voorhees with his mask off until the end of the movie, kind of thing. Yet they'd want to put that on the cover because the video, you know, anything they can do to get you to rent it. They get your money if you rent it. And it's funny how that would work. For example, The Force Awakens came out on Blu-ray months ago for you, but for me it's been recent, and I was shocked, nay, maybe even upset, to look on the cover and on the back, the first image that you show, the very first, because it shows the characters, but the first image that you see is not Rey, it's not Finn, it's not Poe, it's not Old Man Han, it's Luke Skywalker with a gray beard and a hood on. Bullshit, guys! That guy's not even in the effing movie. That's like showing Samuel L. Jackson on the back cover of Iron Man. Anyhow, that bothered me. Why would they do that? Why? He's all over all of the art. I mean, I can understand if you really want to spoil the movie, show Rey with a lightsaber. That's a good spoiler. But they got to go farther than that. Anyway, sorry, I have issues. I guess that's a roundabout way of saying, you know, I just wanted there to be three buttes and some skulls on my cover. Okay, so here we go. This guy wants to pass me. Should I let him pass me or what? What? So as of this recording, there's no cover. But there's also no audiobook. I've got it about halfway halfway edited, but I don't even have the whole thing recorded, and I'm going on this little weekend getaway, but when I come back, I'm planning on finishing it up, and so by the time you're hearing this, it's done, and I hope that it's good, because I've worked really hard on it, and I'm gonna give you another sample of it, and if you plan on buying the book, you might want to not listen to this. It's not super spoilery, but when I wrote this part of the book, I thought, this is what I want to be my sample on Audible. They ask you to do a 5-minute sample that's free, that people can just listen to so they can hear a sampling of your narration. They can hear how crappy the audio quality is, probably. They can hear how good a narrator I am. And what you want to do is provide something that will let them know what they're in for. Usually I will pick something exciting because I want them to, I want this to sell the book. You know what I'm saying? It's like a trailer kind of thing. Now, a lot of times on movies, they show the best part in a trailer. But when I wrote this scene, where Will sort of finds out the problem is worse than he thought, I thought this is going to be the sample chapter because it sets the stage and it tells you what you need to know without telling it, without showing the gremlin on the front cover of the box. So, Will Ford has moved to this little New Mexico town. It's a mining town, and people are disappearing. And they fairly steadily disappear. And some of them move away, but some just are never heard from again. And he's replacing a sheriff who also disappeared. And so Will sort of tries to figure out what has been going on. And he puts a couple of clues together and he decides to go up to this butte that's outside the limits of town. Because that's where the last sheriff apparently went on more than one occasion. So I'm going to play that, and then I'll meet you on the other side.
A hot, dry breeze blew against him as he began to climb again, and he passed a corncob pipe and a harmonica on the way up. Someone had been there, at least, and recently enough that the harmonica still looked playable. From the ground, it hadn't looked that high up, but there had been no peaks even close to this tall back in Oklahoma. He reached the top, sweat running down his neck, his armpits, and down his back, wondering how tough the old sheriff must have been to have made this trip more than once, and at night. On the bluff, he saw the surrounding valley, more hills and declines in the distance, a small, thin stream near where he'd spied the antelope, but nothing suspicious, nothing that would answer any of the questions that he'd... But there was a smell. The ripe, sweet stink of old decomposition. He took a hesitant step toward it, unsure if he wanted to know what the smell was coming from. Will got a strange feeling. He didn't know what it was exactly, but it was a sensation of dread, of waking up in the night and suspecting you were not alone in the dark, a feeling from childhood, when everything was a little bit mystifying. A little bit frightening. But he was the sheriff, and he'd forced himself to bury his fears deep, deep down when his duty called for it. Such as now. He took a few more steps. There was a crack in the sandstone, one that went all the way across the top of the butte. It widened, widened, widened. Right near the edge of the flat ground, the crack got wide enough to step right into. It was here that the smell was strongest. Will heard flies as he approached it. A voice in his head told him he might not want to see what was there. But he stepped forward anyway. It was an awful sight, but not the horror he'd been expecting. Bones, remains, and what was unmistakably fecal matter lay in a pile in the crack, delighting thousands of flies and their young. Will forced his gag reflex back down. The bones and remains were of animals, sheep, cattle. He recognized a horse or donkey skull with just a bit of meat still left on it. Revolting stuff, but nothing he'd never seen before. Except the pile of waste was 10 feet long, at least, and it... Will caught his breath. Sticking between animal fur and dark, dark dung was a cowboy boot. It didn't appear to be attached to anything, but there was a tear in the side of it, made either by a claw or a tooth. Will took a deep inhalation into his handkerchief and peered into the pile again. There was a bit of cloth visible in all that, from a shirt or a dress, and one of the bones looked remarkably like a human femur, the big bone of the leg. It was broken in the middle, writhing with vermin. But Will didn't think it belonged to any animal, unless there were apes out here in New Mexico, which he was 99% sure was not the case. He muttered a little prayer and backed away. The crack extended down the side of the bluff, and when he stepped up to the edge there, he saw it continue down, 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 until it stopped. In a cavern? From here, it appeared so. From the ground, though, even the crack would be hard to see, granted you could even look up from there. Will thought about it. He had his sidearm, which was just 6 shots, and another 3 shells in the back of his belt. If there was an angry grizzly, though how huge would it have to be to drag a horse up here? Or a monster? He would need something more. A rifle, at least. Maybe a cannon.
All right, so there's that. I picked that because, like I said, it sort of sets the tone. It doesn't give away everything, but it gives away, uh-oh. And I like that. I like uh-oh. Previously, I gave the first chapter, which sort of introduces the character of Will Ford and the scenario. This gives the clues to what's going on. And so maybe this is a disservice as well, but you've got to have something in your sample and you've got to have something in a trailer, right? You don't want to mislead. Plus, weird Western, guys. Anyway, self-serving as this episode is, you know me, I find it really difficult to pat myself on the back. I find it really difficult to say, guys, I think that this is a good book. I think you should buy it. I'm proud of it. Really proud of the narration. But I'm going to say all that. I don't know if it's a good book. It's my first book, and people always say that your first novel is going to suck. And you have to allow yourself the permission to suck. Give yourself permission to suck. I don't want it to suck. I don't want this to be a bad book. But who knows? 5 years from now, I may go, ugh. But as of right now in 2016, this is as good as I can do, guys. And maybe I have no more novels in me. More likely I do. I just have to trick myself into thinking that they're short stories or novellas, because those I can write. Novels I cannot. If you have purchased a copy of Into the Furnace, thank you. I really appreciate it. If you have not purchased a copy, I encourage you to do so. I think that there's about a 90% chance that I'm never going to run it on the Rish Outcast. There's other stuff that I am charging for that I think I will run on the Rish Outcast eventually. But this one is just too big. You know what I mean? It would have to be 10 episodes or so, and I'm not going to do that. But I'm not going to talk about it anymore. We've reached the end of another episode. There are links in the show notes to the story on Amazon and to the audiobook. I don't control how much I sell the audiobook for. It just goes by length. But, you know, hopefully you feel that it's worth it after all the hours of free entertainment that I've given you over these last, 8 years. And if you liked it, give it a good review. Or share it with someone, or encourage somebody else to buy it, or, I don't know, let Big Anklevich know that you read my book and you liked it, and now it's time to read a book by him. Thank you, guys. The Rish Outcast is produced under a creative... Wait! Don't do that! What? Oh, guys! Surface Sean Connery! Yes! I've been hiding in your back seat, listening to you fart for the last hour. It was the seat.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Oh, you want to do the Creative Commons thing?
Yes, and then a part of a Pet Shop Boys song.
Really? What?
Just let me say it.
Okay, yeah, go right ahead.
The Rish Outcast is published and produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 license. This license allows you to share it, to copy it, to download it, to listen to it, to have it for dinner with special sauce. But you're not allowed to take credit for it. You're not allowed to edit it or sell it or claim it for your own. You're better than that. Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand, it's pointed at your head. You think you're mad, you're too unstable, you're kicking in chairs and knocking down tables in a restaurant. In a West End town, you call the police, there's a madman around. Run him down, underground to a dive bar in a West End town.
Gross, Sir Fake Sean Connery. Gross.
It was the chair.